Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission here is pretty simple. We plunge into these colossal subjects and try to pull out the essential, the surprising, the stuff you really need to know.
Mm-hmm.
And today we are taking on a true global titan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a place that kind of defies description. It's built on prophecy, on ruins. It's constantly adapting, and it's literally sinking.
It is.
We are deep diving into Mexico City, mm-hmm. or as the 20-plus million people who live there call it, CDMX.
It really is a capital of transformation. I think to understand Mexico City, you just have to accept that every single layer of its history is present all at once.
Right.
You're exploring a city founded by one of the greatest empires in the Americas, then systematically destroyed and rebuilt by the Spanish, all while sitting on a geological time bomb.
So what's our objective today? What are we trying to unpack?
I think our goal is to explore that layered identity,
yeah.
really analyze its precarious geography, and then understand its role as this. Well, this undeniable economic and cultural powerhouse in the 21st century.
Okay, so when we talk about global capitals, this isn't just a big city. It's a monumental center of influence. Where does it actually rank?
It ranks extremely high. There's a group, the Globalization and World Cities Research Network, GIWC, and they monitor how cities fit into the global economy.
Yeah.
In their 2024 ranking, they classify Mexico City as an alpha world city.
An alpha world city. So that puts it up there with places like Paris, Tokyo.
Exactly. Paris, Tokyo, Sydney. It's in that top tier. And in terms of sheer scale, Greater Mexico City has about 21.8 million people.
Wow.
That makes it the sixth largest metro area on the planet. And the city proper, just the core city, is the most populous in all of North America.
That immediately just frames the challenge of trying to manage a place like that.
Yeah.
For decades, most of us knew it as the DF, right? The Distrito Federal. But that name change to CDMX, that signaled a really profound shift.
It absolutely did. The initials DF were common for, well, for a century. But the big political and legal change happened in January 2016. It officially went from being the federal district to Ciudad de Mexico, CDMX. And this was so much more than just a rebranding. It was the result of decades of political struggle to give the city more autonomy. It now has its own constitution, much more like a federal state.
And the city's identity is captured in these two sort of contrasting nicknames. There's the formal, almost regal one, and then the more modern local term.
The regal one is La Ciudad de los Palacios, the City of Palaces.
The City of Palaces.
Yeah, and it dates back to the early 19th century. The famous Prussian explorer Baron Alexander von Humboldt visited the city, and he was just floored. He was so struck by the opulence of the architecture, the huge churches, the fancy private homes. He wrote that it could easily rival any capital in Europe.
That's high praise.
Mm.
But I think the sources note that while he made it famous, he might not have actually coined the term himself.
That's a great little historical nuance. It seems an English politician, Charles Latrobe, might have actually written it first in the 1830s.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote, with a bit of irony, about the luxurious city of palaces, which has risen from the clay-built ruins of Tenochtitlan. That one phrase just perfectly captures the whole story.
Opulence built on top of ruins.
Exactly.
And that's the formal historical view.
Yeah.
But if you're actually from CDMX, what do you call yourself?
You might be called a chilango if you're a man, or a chilanga if we're a woman. And the city itself is sometimes called Chilangolandia.
Chilangolandia. I like that.
But the term has this really interesting social dynamic. Outside of Mexico City, especially in the provinces, chilango is often used as an insult.
But what? What does it imply?
It kind of implies someone who is loud, arrogant, maybe a bit rude. It's that classic provincial resentment of the big, powerful capital.
But the locals have embraced it.
Oh, they absolutely have. Residents of CDMX often use the term with a ton of pride. They've internalized it. That perceived brashness becomes a sign of their resilience, their big city savvy.
And they have their own term for everyone else, right?
They do. They'll call people from outside the capital residents of La Provincia, the provinces. It's a classic urban versus rural thing. And the funny part is the neutral formal term, capitalino, is almost never used in conversation.
So that really sets the stage for this place full of complexity, high culture, deep history, all rubbing up against this very modern, very assertive urban identity. To get how that was forged, we have to start at the beginning, the foundations.
We really do, because Mexico City has this monumental historical distinction that I think often gets overlooked.
What's that?
It is the oldest continuously inhabited capital city in the entire Americas. And on top of that, it's one of only two capitals in the Americas founded by indigenous peoples.
The other being Pito.
the other being keto.
That fact alone just completely reframes its importance, doesn't it? It wasn't just some convenient spot colonizers picked. It was an ancient, powerful city that the Spanish decided to seize.
Exactly. The city was founded by the Mexica people, who we usually call the Aztecs. They established their city, Tenochtitlan, on a group of islands right in the middle of Lake Texcoco. This was around 1325 or 1327.
And they didn't just pick this spot randomly. It was chosen because of a deeply symbolic religious legend.
That's the core of the whole foundation myth. According to their tradition, their main god, Huitzilopochtli, told them to settle where they saw a very specific sign.
The eagle on the cactus.
The golden eagle on a prickly pear cactus devouring a rattlesnake. They saw that sign on a small marshy island, and that's where they founded Tenochtitlan. And that image is so powerful, it's still the central symbol on Mexico's national flag today.
The sheer audacity of building a city on a marshy island is just mind-boggling. What made it so sophisticated when the Spanish showed up?
By the time Cortes arrived in 1519, Tenochtitlan was the heart of the Aztec Empire, which stretched from the Gulf of Mexico all the way to the Pacific. And its sophistication was all about engineering. The Mexica controlled the floodwaters with this massive 10-mile-long defensive barrier, a dike, that separated the salty water of the main lake from the fresh water they needed for the city.
And this is where the famous chinampas, the floating gardens, come in.
Precisely. They were these incredibly productive agricultural plots they made by layering mud and vegetation. They had totally mastered hydroengineering. When Cortes first saw it, Tenochtitlan was one of the largest cities in the world, much bigger than any European city at the time.
The scale of that civilization must have made the conquest that followed incredibly brutal.
The brutality was comprehensive. Cortes, with the help of thousands of indigenous allies who hated the Aztecs, started the siege of Tenochtitlan in May 1521. For 3 months, the city was starved, cut off from water, and just pounded by Spanish weapons.
And then disease played a huge part.
A devastating part. Smallpox, which the Europeans brought with them, had a death rate of up to 90% among the indigenous populations. It was a perfect storm of violence and biology.
So when the last Aztec ruler finally surrendered in August 1521, what was actually left of the capital?
Almost nothing. The sources say almost nothing. Cortes made a strategic call to basically raise the city during the final siege. The rebuilding, though, was incredibly fast.
Why so fast?
Political necessity. He had to consolidate Spanish power immediately. And rebuilding on the side of Tenochtitlan was a clear message. Uh-huh. We conquer your center of power, and we're putting our new order right on top of it.
And that act, that superimposition, is what defines the historic center today. They used the old city's blueprint, but just built over it.
Absolutely. They kept the basic four-quadrant layout of Tenochtitlan, but they leveled the old structures and built the Spanish power center right on top. The best example is the Zoclo, the main square.
Which was the Aztec ceremonial center.
Right. They demolished the Templo Mayor, the main temple, and they used its stones, its foundation, to build the massive metropolitan cathedral right beside it, and even partially over the ruins.
So it's historical layering made physical. Yeah. You can actually see it.
You literally can. When you visit today, you can see the excavated ruins of the Aztec temple right beneath the foundations of the colonial cathedral.
The amount of work required for that? The destruction and the construction in the 16th century, it's almost impossible to grasp.
It was a colossal forced effort. And we have an eyewitness account that really drives home the human cost.
What's that?
A Franciscan friar, Toribio de Benavente Motolinia, was one of the first missionaries. And he categorized the massive reconstruction effort, which relied on what was basically indigenous slave labor, as one of the seven plagues of the early colonial period.
The seventh plague.
Yeah.
Building Mexico City. What made it so catastrophic, according to him?
He just painted this harrowing picture. He described crowds of laborers so huge you could barely move on the causeways. They had to tear down the old buildings, often just with their hands, and then build these massive new stone structures. He specifically noted how many died. He wrote, "Many died from being crushed by beams or falling from high places or in tearing down old buildings for new ones." It was just a brutal industrial-scale use of human labor to turn the Aztec capital into the capital of New Spain.
A tragic origin. But once it was established, it quickly became this magnet for wealth.
Yeah.
Which brings us back to that nickname, the City of Palaces.
It was a total magnet for capital. It was the administrative and cultural hub of the viceroyalty. All the wealth from the silver mines, the ports, the farms, it all flowed into the capital.
So noble families, made their money elsewhere, but spent it in the city.
Exactly. They built these extravagant homes, the palacios. They funded charities, commissioned art, imported luxury goods. And this all peaked in the late 18th century, which is when the city really cemented its reputation as a rival to Madrid or Paris in its splendor.
But all that splendor was built on layers of ruin and on ground that couldn't support it.
And that is the fundamental challenge that defines the modern city, its unique and highly precarious geography.
Which is where things get really interesting.
The geography of CDMX is the source of pretty much all its problems, historical and modern.
So set the scene for us.
Okay, so the city is in the Valley of Mexico, high up on the Central Plateau. The elevation is significant, 2,240 meters, or about 7,350 feet. And it's in a basin surrounded by these towering volcanic mountains.
High altitude, surrounded by mountains. It sounds like a perfect protected spot. So what's the paradox?
The paradox is water. The valley was a closed basin. All the water that flowed down from the mountains had no natural way to get out.
Ah, okay.
So this created a huge system of lakes, including Lake Texcoco. The Aztecs engineered ways to manage it, but when the Spanish destroyed those dikes, the flood risk came back with a vengeance.
So the Spanish inherited a city that was constantly flooding, and their solution was pretty drastic. Drain the entire lake.
That was the only way they thought they could make it sustainable. They started these massive, centuries-long engineering projects called the desagüe, the drainage system.
Centuries-long.
Yeah. Starting in the 17th century, they literally cut through the mountains to create an artificial outlet for the water. It was an incredible feat of engineering for its time, and over the centuries, they completely drained Lake Texcoco.
Turning the lake bed into dry land for the city to grow.
Exactly. And that dry former lake bed is the root of the city's existential crisis today. Subsidence.
The ground is collapsing.
The ground is collapsing. The city rests on what is basically soft, saturated clay, ancient lake mud. As the city grew, it started pumping massive amounts of groundwater from the aquifer underneath that clay.
And when the water's gone, the clay compacts and the ground just drops.
That's it. And the data is terrifying.
Give us the numbers again, because they're really important.
In some central areas, since the start of the 20th century, the city has sunk up to 9 meters.
9 meters, that's almost 30 feet.
About 30 feet of vertical loss. And this isn't a historical problem, it's ongoing. In some parts of the historic center, it's still sinking at a rate of almost 50 centimeters.
20 inches.
Every single year.
Every year. That's just, I can't even wrap my head around that. How does that affect daily life? How does the infrastructure even function?
The consequences are a mess. First, you have structural damage. The sinking is uneven, so buildings lean and crack. The Metropolitan Cathedral, the Palacio de Bellas Artes, they're famous examples of this. But the biggest problem is for infrastructure that relies on gravity.
The sewage system.
The sewage system. It's a nightmare. It's supposed to flow downhill, right? But when the ground sinks at different rates, you end up with sections where the pipes actually have to move sewage uphill.
So it requires constant, expensive pumping.
Constant pumping, and it causes blockages. And worst of all, it brings back the original flood risk. When the heavy rains come, the city's ability to drain the water is severely limited, so you get chronic flooding.
So the battle against water, they thought they won by draining the lake. Mm. It just created a new vulnerability. And then on top of all that, earthquakes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That soft, saturated soil amplifies the shaking from an earthquake. It can turn a minor tremor into a catastrophe. The 1985 earthquake is the defining moment.
That quake was a turning point, wasn't it? Politically as much as physically.
Immensely. The physical damage was horrific, but the political fallout was what really changed things. The government, which was this monolithic one-party system, was just paralyzed.
How so?
The sources describe it as being overwhelmed by its own bureaucracy and corruption. They just failed to organize effective rescue efforts.
And the citizens stepped in.
The ordinary citizens stepped in. It was an organic, powerful response. Neighbors organized rescue brigades, dug through rubble, started rebuilding houses, often going directly against government orders.
Wow.
That event exposed the government's weakness, and it really lit a fire under a new era of civil society, of people demanding more control over their own city.
So geology and governance all colliding.
Yeah.
But in contrast to this sinking crisis, the city managed a truly remarkable environmental turnaround with its air quality.
It's an incredible success story. People who remember the city from the 80s or 90s just can't believe it. It was infamous for having some of the worst air pollution on Earth. Now it's a global model for how to fix it.
How big was the improvement?
It was huge. By 2014, levels of things like carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, they had dropped by two-thirds or more compared to the early 90s. The city's air quality is now comparable to a city like Los Angeles.
That kind of turnaround for a megacity that doesn't happen by accident. What did they do?
They attacked it on three fronts: transportation, industry, and policy. The most famous policy is the Hoy No Circula program.
One day without a car.
Right. It restricts which cars can drive based on the last number of your license plate. To enforce it, cars have to pass strict emissions tests twice a year. If you don't pass, or if it's your day, you can't drive. Period.
And they invested heavily in public transit to give people an alternative.
Absolutely. That was key. They built out the massive Metrobus System Bus Rapid Transit and the huge Ecobici bike sharing network. It was a multi-pronged approach that demanded both sacrifice from individuals and massive investment from the government.
That success really shows the city has the capacity for innovation when it needs it. Which brings us to its modern governance and economic power.
And its economic pull is just overwhelming. With 21.8 million people in the greater metro area, its dominance is just a given. It is the undisputed economic engine of Mexico.
What percentage of the national economy are we talking about here?
The city proper is responsible for about 15.8% of the country's GDP.
Just the city.
Just the city. And when you add the whole metro area, it's about 22% of the national GDP. And get this, if Mexico City were its own country back in 2013, its economy would have been the fifth largest in all of Latin America.
That is staggering. But this economy has changed a lot, right? It used to be an industrial center.
A huge industrial center. The shift was dramatic, and it was mostly fueled by the NAFTA agreement in the 90s. Back in 1980, half of all industrial jobs in Mexico were inside the city limits.
Half. So why did that manufacturing base leave?
It just got too expensive. Land prices went up, traffic was a nightmare, and the environmental regulations for the air quality cleanup made it costly to operate.
So manufacturing moved out and something else moved in.
Exactly. The city shifted to managing things instead of making them. It doubled down on services, finance, corporate headquarters, banking, tech. That move cemented CDMX as one of Latin America's most critical financial hubs.
And let's connect that economic power back to the political structure. That change from DF to CDMX wasn't just handed to them.
No, it was a decades-long struggle for self-determination. For most of its history, the president just appointed the city's leader. Residents had no direct vote.
And the 1985 earthquake was a major catalyst for change.
A huge catalyst. People started demanding control. They finally won the right to elect their head of government in 1997. And the ultimate achievement was that 2016 reform, which gave them their own constitution.
And that decentralized power in a big way.
Significantly.
Yeah.
The 16 boroughs, the alcaldías, got their own elected mayors with real budgetary power. It gave local communities way more control over their own neighborhoods.
But there's still one crucial legal limitation. It can't become a full state.
Right, and that's fundamental. The Constitution says it can't become a state as long as it's the seat of federal power. If it did, the capital would have to move somewhere else. So it has this unique, powerful, but always tied to the federation status.
And that autonomy has allowed it to become a laboratory for progressive social policy, way ahead of the rest of the country.
Absolutely. Since the late 90s, its politics have been much more liberal than the rest of Mexico. A huge example is reproductive rights.
Right.
Mexico City was the first federal entity to significantly expand abortion access, which was a massive departure from traditional law.
And it was also a trailblazer on LGBTQ plus rights in the region.
A total trailblazer. In 2009, it became the first city in all of Latin America to legalize same-sex marriage. That set a critical precedent. They've also pioneered things like no-fault divorce and legal gender change. It's consistently been a progressive bulwark.
Given all that, how diverse is the population?
It's deeply diverse. Internally, it's a major hub for indigenous groups migrating from rural areas. The most common indigenous languages you'll hear are Nahuatl, Otomi, and Mixtec.
And what about internationally?
It's huge. The capital has one of the world's largest expat communities. It's estimated to have the largest population of Americans living outside the U.S.
Really? How many?
The numbers are as high as 700,000. They're drawn by the economy, the cost of living, and, of course, the city's powerful cultural magnetism.
That vast scale requires an equally impressive cultural scene to match. Let's dive into what defines the CDMX experience. Its culture, cuisine, and connectivity.
When you talk culture in Mexico City, you're really talking about density and volume. The city has about 170 museums. That number alone puts it in the top 10 cities globally for museum density. You could spend a lifetime just exploring them.
And a lot of these landmarks are themselves evidence of the city's geological struggle.
Absolutely. The Palacio de Bellas Artes, that beautiful white marble opera house, is the perfect example. It is literally gradually sinking into the soft lake bed under its own weight.
A beautiful casualty of subsidence.
Exactly. It's a living demonstration of that conflict between architecture and geology.
So what are the absolute can't-miss cultural spots?
Oh, there are so many, but three stand out. First, the National Museum of Anthropology. It's world-renowned. It houses the famous Aztec calendar stone, the Sunstone.
Right.
Second, the Museo Soumaya. Its architecture is incredible, and it holds the largest private collection of original Rodin sculptures outside of France.
The largest private collection of Rodin.
Yeah.
In Mexico City. That's astonishing.
It really speaks to the private wealth there. And third, you have the great muralists, Rivera, Siqueiros, Orozco. Their massive politically charged murals are all over public buildings like the National Palace. And of course, you have Frida Kahlo's home, the Casa Azul, in Coyoacán.
And UNESCO has recognized the city's importance as well.
It has. CDMX has three distinct UNESCO World Heritage sites, which is incredibly rare for one city. You have the Historic Center, the floating gardens of Xochimilco, and the main campus of the UNAM University.
Okay, let's pivot to food. The culinary scene is globally recognized now, but it has this incredible balance of high-end dining and historic street food.
That balance is what makes it so great. The formal recognition really came in 2024 when seven city restaurants got Michelin stars, and the restaurant Pujol is consistently ranked one of the best in the world.
But the daily reality for millions is markets and tacos.
That's the real pulse of the city. The food traditions go back centuries. Take the taco. In the 19th century, it was considered simple, plebeian fare, but now it's everything. And CDMX is where Tacos Al Pastor came from.
Which is that fusion of Lebanese shawarma techniques with local ingredients.
Exactly. From immigrants in the 1930s. And the markets that feed the city are on another level.
What kind of scale are we talking?
The Central de Abasto is the main produce market for the whole city. It's a massive 24/7 operation. And then La Nueva Viga Market is the second largest seafood market in the world.
Second only to Tsukiji in Japan.
Second only to Tsukiji.
And what about the traditional drinking culture?
That's where you find the pulquerias. They're these working class bars that serve pulque, a traditional drink made from fermented maguey sap. They have this very distinct traditional vibe that's a world away from the high-end cocktail bars.
So to move all those people and all that food around, you need a massive transit system.
And CDMX has one of the best in the region. The metro is the largest in Latin America. It's got 12 lines, 195 stations.
And it moves how many people a day?
An astonishing 4.4 million people every single day. It's the city's circulatory system.
And they've made a big push to integrate everything recently.
They have. All public transport, the metro, metrobus, trolleybuses, are under one unified system now. Makes it much easier to get around. And the Ecobici bike sharing system is the second largest in North America.
Finally, we can't talk about a global capital without talking about sports.
And its sporting footprint is monumental. The Azteca Stadium seats over 91,000 fans. It's the largest in Latin America.
It's historic.
It's incredibly historic. Mexico City is the only Latin American city to ever host the Summer Olympics back in 68. And the Azteca is the first stadium in history to host two separate FIFA World Cup finals.
1970 and 1986.
Exactly. And they continue to host huge events like the NFL, Formula One. The sheer scope of life in the city is just unmatched.
This deep dive has really revealed that Mexico City isn't just defined by transformation, but by resilience. It's a place constantly shaped by these overlapping identities.
Mm.
The spiritual center of the Mexica, the glittering capital of New Spain, the progressive heart of a modern nation, and this economic engine for Latin America. It's a city that has just had to learn to adapt to political upheaval and this constant terrifying pressure of sinking ground.
I think the underlying story of CDMX is really a physical conflict between water and land. It's always been there.
Right.
From the moment the Mexica built dikes to manage the lake, through the centuries of Spanish projects to drain it, it's always been about humans trying to engineer the environment and the consequences of that engineering, the subsidence. That's still the greatest test of the city's endurance.
We saw the success they had with air quality, but the water crisis, the sinking, that's the existential threat. So what does this mean for the future?
Well, the source material mentions this conceptual project, a plan called Recovering the City of Lakes. It's an ambitious ecological plan to reintroduce natural water sources, create new wetlands, and basically improve the water supply and air quality by partially restoring the old ecosystem.
So embracing the water again instead of fighting it.
Exactly. So considering the city's founding conflict with water and the continuous problem of subsidence, we have to ask the critical question. How might a project like that, one that tries to reverse centuries of human intervention, fundamentally change the physical fate and the future identity of CDMX?
That is a powerful thought to take away, as the Capital de la Transformación just keeps evolving and fighting for its very foundation. Thank you for diving deep with us.